Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to the Kottke Ride Home for Wednesday, February 17th, 2021. I'm Jackson Bird. A historical defense for arranging book collections by color. Scientists have sequenced the oldest DNA ever found and made some mammoth discoveries in the process. And NASA's Perseverance rover is set to touch down on Mars tomorrow. Some background on one experiment it will be running that could set the stage for human travel to the red planet. Here are some of the cool things from the news today. It's not a new debate, but it's one that's been rearing its head more often over the last year as Zoom calls and remote televised interviews give us peeks into people's homes. I am talking about the proper way to organize a bookshelf. Now, of course, there are tons of different methods for organizing your books, and which one you choose will have a lot to do with your collection, the space available in your home, and ultimately the type of person you are. But there is one type of organizational method that's been growing in popularity over the last decade that seems to particularly get a lot of people up in arms. Organizing one's books by color. Now, Jason posted a quick link on Kottke.org today to a blog by Alexander Alvis, aka Book Historia, which defends these so-called rainbow shelves with some fascinating insights into the history of books. Alvis, who is a legit book historian with a master's degree on the topic, something I didn't realize was a career option, begins with a few reasons why rainbow shelves bug some people. You know, perhaps we still have a disconnect between things that are aesthetically pleasing and things that indicate true intellect. And that if something is so nicely displayed, it must not actually be used. We also can't ignore that the types of people who often organize by color tend to be women and or feminine-leaning people. I would personally add that it also tends to be popular among people who read young adult books, who are forever berated by fellow adults who do not. And I'm just going to say right at the start here that I am in favor of people organizing or not organizing their book collections however they please. Especially as an author, I'm just grateful to anyone who is willing and able to buy books. That's great. I don't personally enjoy the color-coded organizational style for my own books, in part because I don't think I'd ever be able to find anything, but also because I think my book collection is gay enough without needing to be organized by rainbow. But this isn't about my preferences, this is about history and ways that books have been organized and displayed in the past. Now, one point that particularly blew my mind here is that for several centuries, roughly from the advent of the printing press through the Industrial Revolution, people actually bought their books unbound. They just bought a stack of pages, and it was up to them to bind them. So people with means, who were most of the people buying books anyways, would get custom bindings for all of their books. Some people wanted every single one to look exactly the same on their shelves. Some would organize the bindings by genre or discipline. The British Museum employed this method with, quoting 19th century English publisher Joseph Cundell, "Books of divinity are bound in blue, history in red, poetry in yellow, and biography in olive-colored leather," end quote. And some bookbinders encouraged collectors to organize their books as such, both to aid in finding certain texts, but also to give their libraries some color, instead of having the whole room in monochrome. Of course, there were other ways of organizing too. Some did it by height, and Sir Robert Cotton organized his books by, quoting Book Historia, "convenience and proximity to marble busts of Roman emperors," end quote. So, all right, yeah, book collectors could definitely be a bit eccentric. Book Historia also quickly references another organizational system that gets a lot of hate online these days, but also has a historical precedent: shelving your books with the spine in. Now, whereas rainbow shelvers are accused of being too immature or just posing as book lovers, people who have posted rooms with shelves filled with books spine in are ridiculed as having no interest in reading at all. I mean, clearly those books are just props for your Instagram beige interior design. How could you possibly ever find a book when all that's displayed are its off-white pages? Well, it turns out this used to be the norm. Up until about the late 18th century, many books were shelved with their fore edges out, so much so that books used to be extensively decorated or stamped with their catalog information on those fore edges, on the pages, like your elementary school teacher may have taught you to do in case the cover ever got ripped off your book. And the reason for this was that books, again, were expensive, so libraries literally used to chain the books to the shelves to prevent theft. Stephanie Silverne calls it, quote, "the medieval equivalent to the electronic security devices our libraries use today," end quote. So the chains were connected to clasps on either cover, so you could pull the book out and open it without unchaining it. Therefore, it made sense to shelve it with the clasps facing out, aka spine in. Now, I know that's not why anyone shelving spine in does it nowadays, but it is interesting to look back and see that it's a thing that people used to do. And in fairness, another thing that's not new is people being outraged at other people's book organizational styles, especially when the critic perceives it to be faux intellectual or purely decorative. Book Historia points out that this was happening even in the first century. Seneca, quote, "railed against people without a scholarly education, using books not as the tools of learning, but as decorations for the dining room," end quote. So people are always going to judge. But a few more points inspired by some of Book Historia's arguments. In all these historical examples, we're talking about books that were extravagantly designed, often custom designed. You know, they were absolutely going to make a statement and look awesome on your shelf no matter what. But these days, most books aren't quite so lavishly styled. I mean, there's some amazing cover art out there, of course, but leather-bound, gilded-edged books aren't exactly the norm. Sometimes, though, even a mass-market paperback can look nicer depending on what other books it's lined up besides. Almost like picking an outfit, you know, a shirt might look meh until you add a sweater or a necklace or something, and then suddenly it looks great. And anyone who has enough books to arrange them by color has a lot of books, which means unless they box them up and put them in a closet, those books are naturally going to take up a large amount of visual space in their home. For some of us, books are like our primary object for interior design, so if a rainbow spectrum works with the rest of your home's design, then I say go for it. Why not? And as for debates about how anyone could possibly find a book when it's organized by color, while it doesn't work for me, color coding is a tried and true strategy for all kinds of organizing and learning methods. Book Historia points out how any librarian or bookseller has heard a million times, "I don't remember the title, but it's got a blue cover." For some people, a visual organizational style really does work. But no matter how you choose to organize your book collection or not, if you have a collection you're proud of, especially if it's on a particular topic, and you happen to be a woman under the age of 30, you should check out the 5th annual Honey and Wax Book Collecting Prize. It's a $1,000 prize that will go to a young woman in the U.S. who has started, quote, "a coherent group of printed or manuscript items creatively put together," end quote. It's an interesting initiative aimed at diversifying the field of book history by encouraging more young women to get involved or take pride in what they may not even realize they're already doing. If that sounds like something that you'd want to apply for or share with someone else, you can read more about it at the LitHub link in the show notes. A team of scientists have sequenced DNA from some mammoth teeth that are over a million years old, making it the oldest DNA yet recovered. Not only that, but the DNA is shedding new light on a previously unknown lineage of mammoths. And when most people think of mammoths, they think of woolly mammoths, but those are just one type of mammoth, and in fact, the last of the mammoths to roam the Earth. Quoting Gizmodo, "Mammoths are believed to have originated in Africa approximately 5 million years ago, with populations traveling north into what is now Eurasia and eventually moving into North America. We still have much to learn about these ancient proboscidean predecessors, which is why this new research is remarkably important. We know, for example, that woolly mammoths were adapted for life in the high Arctic. They could withstand the cold, they could survive on the available vegetation, and they grew thick, tangled hair that gave rise to their name. But when did these adaptations appear? And what about the mammoth species that lived before their woolly counterparts?" End quote. To answer these questions, scientists turned to three different samples of mammoth teeth that were discovered in Siberia in the 1970s. And while the teeth were discovered nearly 50 years ago, it was only in the last decade that the technology advanced enough to be able to sequence and study their DNA. And because they're all older than the previously oldest DNA on record, the researchers weren't even positive at first that they would be able to obtain any DNA at all. By studying the teeth, they were able to discern that, quoting again, "many of the cold adaptations actually evolved in mammoths prior to the emerge of the woolly mammoth as a distinct species. Unlike previously believed, woolly mammoths didn't evolve these adaptations over time. They already had them. Those adaptations appear to have evolved in one of its mammoth predecessors, a species that lived throughout Eurasia, the steppe mammoth," end quote. This could change what scientists previously believed steppe mammoths looked like. They may have been woollier and more cold-adapted. And the oldest mammoth specimen whose molars were studied, nicknamed Krestovka, turned out to be a kind of hybrid. Quote, "they were looking at a completely unknown lineage of mammoth, which coexisted with woolly mammoths during the Middle Pleistocene in Siberia. To date, we have no other fossils that offer more details of this type of mammoth. Moreover, the lineage represented by Krestovka appears to have bred with woolly mammoths, leading to the emergence of the Columbian mammoth. In other words, they found the ancestor to an eventual mammoth hybrid that moved out of Siberia and into North America, becoming what we now know as the enormous Columbian mammoth." End quote. This whole study is one small step for mammoths and one giant leap for our understanding of evolution and history. As science continues to progress at a breakneck speed and with the many well-preserved specimens continuing to be uncovered in Siberia, there will likely be so much more we are able to discover about life on Earth a million or even more years ago. So tomorrow, Thursday, February 18th, is the big day when NASA's Perseverance rover is set to land on Mars. You can watch live on NASA's site. Coverage will kick off at 2:15 p.m. Eastern, and Perseverance is expected to touch down somewhere in the 3 o'clock hour. Perseverance will be landing on the Jezero Crater, which Thomas Serbukin from the Science Mission Directorate at NASA headquarters calls, quote, "the most challenging Martian terrain ever targeted for a landing," end quote. And the reason this tricky location was picked is because Perseverance's overall mission is to learn more about the history of possible ancient life on Mars. And scientists believe that an ancient river may have flowed in the Jezero Basin and could have some signs of past life. But while Perseverance is mostly focused on the past, the mission will also run a few experiments to potentially support life on Mars in the future. One such experiment, which happens to share a name with my favorite soda, is called MOXIE, or Mars Oxygen In Situ Resource Utilization Experiment. The goal is to turn Mars's carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere into oxygen, which one day is what would be needed for both astronauts and rockets. Quoting Space.com, the device is essentially the reverse of a fuel cell, which burns a mix of oxygen and a carbon-based compound to produce heat and carbon dioxide. The instrument also closely resembles a significantly more mundane object. Of course, MOXIE is a little tree, right? Said the experiment's principal investigator, Michael Hecht. Trees take carbon dioxide and turn it into oxygen with a much more complicated chemical process, end quote. MOXIE is only one small part of the overall mission, and because it uses a ton of energy to run, just about the rover's entire supply for a day, it will probably only run about once every few months. Quoting Space.com again, there are a few risks in creating this reaction as well. First, MOXIE can't use up all of the carbon dioxide it takes in. If it does, it may slip into making carbon soot instead of carbon monoxide. Another tricky balance is that if the instrument doesn't receive enough electricity, the reaction will reverse, running like a typical fuel cell. We have to be very careful not to let it operate as a fuel cell, since there's no fuel and it will start eating itself, Hecht said. Since there's no source of oxygen on Mars, it will actually start ripping out oxygen from the anode side of the device and start breaking down the material. End quote. So it's a delicate operation, but it is a major step forward in testing out some of the technology we'll need if we ever do send humans to Mars. But for now, we humans will watch safely from Earth, and if you really want to celebrate, you can hop on over to your nearest Krispy Kreme for an exclusive Mars-themed donut, available only tomorrow. The Mars Donut is a chocolate cream donut dipped in caramel icing with a cool red swirl and cookie crumbles. And if you are one of the 11 million people who signed up for NASA's Send Your Name to Mars promotion, you can take the boarding pass you received as a confirmation from that into Krispy Kreme, and your Mars donut will be on the house. Also, since supply is limited, if you're worried about your local Krispy Kreme running out, you can also pre-order a Mars donut online ahead of time. So links to get your donut and to watch Perseverance's landing are in the show notes. Well, that is it for today. As always, this show was produced by Ride Home Media and Kottke.org. I am Jackson Bird, and I am going to go rearrange my book collection alphabetically by first letter of the third chapter. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
You love podcasts. The stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.